Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 15th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Terence Fretheim. Session number is 98-3 and is titled, A God of Creation. Does God Need You? Let's listen in.
Alert the tape people that I'm Terry Fretheim, and this session is entitled God and Creation. Does God Need You? To even presume to talk about the first couple of chapters in Genesis in an hour is pretty far off. But I want to zero in on a particular concern this morning that relates to some of the relational kinds of material interrelatedness conversation that we had yesterday, and talk about a relational model of creation. That's sort of what I'm about. Just generally, at the beginning, you know that as in the case of any book, the first pages of a book are important in the reading of the whole book. One of the problems in reading the Bible is that we tend to read it piecemeal. We tend to dip into a text there, a sermon text here, and a devotional text there, and we don't read it as a book. I mean, it's many books, sure, but it is a book, finally. And so the first pages of this book are especially important. The ones who finally put this Bible together put those pages where they are for a reason. Now, what's the reason? What's the rhetorical strategy of those who put this book together, the Bible? And they give us these initial pages as the sort of the first pages into your head. And one could work with varying possibilities, I suppose. But it's notable that the Bible doesn't start out talking about the baptized. And the Bible doesn't start out talking about Israel. The chosen people are not mentioned for 10 chapters. And even more, the first few verses of this book don't even mention human beings. Readers have, it takes quite a few verses before human readers, get to a character that looks like they do. And then they discover that they don't even get a day by themselves. They've got to share the sixth day with the animals. I mean, that's a put down. And isn't it striking that the language of valuation for the human beings, it's good, it's good, it's good. You get the human beings, it's good, it's good. I mean, no, new. Hey, this is really special, folks. Although, we'll have to see, the image of God language is used in a special way for human beings, but not the language of evaluation. So the Bible then, readers must visualize and ponder every other creature before they get to one that looks like they do. So the Bible opening talks about a world which includes much more than human beings and includes every human being. And so readers of this book, in its very first pages, are invited to view a screen that's cosmic in its scope. And you're invited to engage in an act of imagination that takes you way beyond your little world into the universe. So I'd like to suggest that the strategy of the editors of this book, the Bible, in its very first pages, is to give you, the reader, a universal frame of reference. A universal frame of reference in the light of which to read everything that follows. I'd like to say that the opening chapter of Genesis is kind of like a literary spacecraft. it provides a, you know, that picture of the blue picture of the Earth that has been, this is a literary spacecraft, which you get a remarkable view of a good, a diverse, a well-functioning, and an incredibly beautiful universe. And redemption is not yet in view. The chosen people are not yet in view. The baptized are not yet in view. You're asked to begin with this universe in your head and read everything that follows in the light of that. Now this universe, this universal frame of reference, includes God. God's more universal than the universe. It's interesting that this, the editors, in starting out the Bible, don't even bother to introduce God to you. It just says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and you've got now to, who is this God? And that picture begins to be filled out as you read. And one of the key questions that I ask you to think about this morning is, what kind of God is this opening chapter of Genesis presenting to you? What kind of God do you have here? I think a traditional image of this God in Genesis is a highly independent being who speaks a word and poof, the world comes into being. I think that's a very common understanding of the God of Genesis 1. And I'd like to say that's way out of sync with some of the key materials with which we have to do in this chapter. A common understanding of this material is a hierarchical understanding, where you get God at the top of the pyramid, and then you get human beings created who are to have dominion over everything else. I would like to suggest that what we have in this chapter is a complex reality of independence, dependence, and interdependence. And not only are human beings and non-human beings dependent, so is God. God, human beings, and non-humans are all, in some respects, independent, dependent, and interdependent. Now, this is something that God has freely chosen to do, of course. We could talk about that. Let me read a short paragraph from a theologian, German theologian named Michael Welker. This is from Theology Today, Periodical Theology Today, 1991. It's an article entitled, Rereading Genesis 1 and 2. Where the conventional guiding conceptions of creation focus upon division and hierarchical arrangement, these Genesis accounts emphasize the connectedness and the cooperation of creator and that which is creaturely. In no way do the creation accounts of Genesis offer only a gloomy picture of sheer dependence. God's creative action does not confront that which is created with completely finished facts. The creature's own activity is a constitutive element in the process of creation and is seen to be in harmony with the action of God. Now let me kind of, I'm going to work with that. There's a lot in those sentences, and to see when, see what we might come up with here. Let's look at some texts. Genesis 1. Let's start with verse 11. And God said, "Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it. And it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation. Who's doing the creating here? Who's doing the creating? The earth at least is involved. God says, let the earth bring forth, and the earth brings forth. So God doesn't always create directly in this text. God works through that which has already been created to create still further things. Look at verse 20. And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky. And so here God becomes the subject in verse 21. God created the great sea monsters, but it's not as if God decided, well, the waters can't do this, so I'll do it myself, or something like that. The waters have become engaged and involved in the creative process in verse 21, and God doesn't back away from a continued involvement in the creative process, but God's not the only one involved. Or verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind, and it was so. Okay, note here that God is the subject of the creating process, certainly. God is the initiator of and creator of all things. I mean, we wouldn't want to make those claims. But in the process of bringing the creation into being, God involves creatures in that process, in the continuing creation of the world. God chooses not to do everything all by himself. Now let's come back to Genesis 1:4. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God is the subject of the verb to separate there. God is the separator. But then let's go down to verse 7. And so God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome, and it was so. And God called the dome sky. Notice, I should have started with verse 6, sorry. Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. Notice who's involved in the task of separation here. It's not simply God. The dome is involved in the task of separation. The firmament in the older translations. Or let's go down to verse 14. And God said, let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night. Notice again that the creatures are involved with God in the task of separating, which is an integral part of the creative process. And then notice verse 16. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. Thought God was the ruler. But here the language of ruling is given, is assumed not simply by God, which is, by the way, the case in other ancient Near Eastern creation texts. There the gods are the ones who rule. Here, creatures are given some ruling capacity and ruling status within the larger created order of things, not simply God. Now, what I'd like to do is move shortly to the involvement of the human. Now, all of these texts involve the non-human, God catching up, that which is not God, but which is not human either, catching them up in the creative process, involving them in the continuing creation of the world. When it comes to human beings, we have in 1:26-27, human beings created in the image of God. In the image of God. Immediately, you're asked, well, okay, who's this God? I'm created in the image of what kind of God? Now, a traditional understanding of the God of Genesis, the opening chapters of Genesis, is that God is understood fundamentally in terms of overwhelming power, of absolute control, of independent unilateral action in bringing the creation into being. Now, if human beings are created in the image of that kind of God, then what you and I are called to do is we are called to relate to the rest of the creation in terms of overwhelming power, in terms of independent unilateral action and domination. Because that's, we're to mirror God, right? We're to be like God, right? We're in the image of God. And if you've got a dominating, independent, unilaterally acting God in Genesis 1, then that's what you're called to do with regard to the rest of the creation. The kind of God with whom you have to do affects how you shape your life, including your relationship to the rest of the creation. When God now in Genesis 1:28 says, have dominion, what kind of dominion are you going to have? And the God who we've seen already in these texts suggests this is a God who doesn't keep all power to God's self. God involves that which is not God in the continuing creative process. God shares power. Now, what's the very first thing that God says to the newly created human beings? Very first thing, chapter 1, verse 28.
Be fruitful, multiply.
Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion. One would have thought maybe that the first thing God would have said to the newly created human beings is, down on your knees and worship me, I'm God. Or maybe it might have been a first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. Remember that. But isn't it intriguing? The very first words God gives to the newly created human beings is, I'm giving you some power. I'm giving you some power to exercise in taking care of the world. Now, what kind of dominion are you going to have? The image of God that we see in these opening texts is crucial, because if you've got this overwhelming power, unilaterally acting, independent acting God, then the natural world becomes available to the image of God for human manipulation, for exploitation, and we have seen over the years how human beings have dominated the non-human creation in an effort, I think, often, to stand in the image of this Creator God that's commonly presented to us. Our treatment of the non-human world as a passive object for our use is, I'm afraid, due all too commonly to an understanding of God that all of the creation is simply passive putty in the hands of God, that God does with what God pleases. Now, let's come back to yesterday, and our little look at verse 26. God said, let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion. Let us. We indicated yesterday that the us here referred to a divine community, those angelic beings surrounding God, with whom God consulted. There's a relationship of mutuality here. God engaged that which is other than God in the creation of the world. We notice that this is rhetorically in Genesis, you get let there be, let there be, let there be, and then you get this let us, this more dialogical way of working that comes to be when it comes to the creation of humankind. So this God who shares power with the rest of the divine community, now notice that the human being is made in our image. In our image. So that it catches up the entire divine community in thinking of what image of God involves. And so I think that this entails, at the least, that the let us is an implicit understanding of the human, of God's involving the human in comparable power sharing, comparable creative activity in the bringing of the world into being, in what comes, we'll see in chapter 2 in just a minute. Saying God, then God says, let them have dominion. God chooses not to retain all power to God's self. And God, I think the language of subdue the earth, for example. Why would a command like that be, subdue the earth, be needed if everything was good? It must mean that good does not mean perfect. That there's still work on the creation to do. Before it comes to be the way in which God would like it to be. And this text then is initially, look at chapter 2, verse 5. At the end of verse 4, in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, when no plant of the field was yet in the earth, and no herb of the field had yet sprung up. Why? For the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was no one to till the ground. Notice the integral place of the human in the development of the creation there. There's no rain and there's no human being. So that human beings are given responsibility for intra-creational development, for bringing the world along toward its fullest possible creative possibilities. Human activity is considered crucial for the becoming of the creation. Creation is becoming. It's not static in its fundamental character. And creative capacities are given to the created, including the human, for this task of continuing creation. Now, let's go to chapter 2, verse 18 following to see how this is spelled out a little bit. By the way, just for your little tuck in a little note along the way, the verb in verse chapter 2, verse 5, there's no one to till the ground. The verb to till there is avav, which means, in most contexts, means to serve. Moses is the servant of God, the suffering servant. That's the same root. And so one could translate this, that there was no one to serve the ground. And so then when you get down into verse 15, the Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to till it, to serve it, and to keep it, to take care of it. Then we go to verse 18. And the Lord God said, it's not good that the man should be alone. Excuse me? God, I mean, you just said all over chapter 1 it was good. And now you come around and say, it's not good? It's not good. It's not good that the man should be alone. And I'll make him a helper as his partner. So, look at the move that God makes. So out of the ground, the Lord God formed every animal of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. Now, who did the naming back in chapter 1? Look back in chapter 1, and you get verse 5. God called the light day and called the darkness night. Verse 8, God called the dome sky. Verse 10, God called the dry land earth. And then God quits calling. And now in verse chapter 2, you get all the animals being brought before the man. And who does the naming this time? It's the human being who does the naming. The human being is caught up by God in the process of creation. Because naming, of course, is important in terms of ordering the creation which is basically what these texts are about. So, verse 5, notice at the end of verse 19 of chapter 2, whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. Whatever. Now, Phyllis Trible has got it in her book, God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality, has a marvelous sentence which she explicates that, and she says this: God is present not as the authoritarian controller of events, but as the generous delegator of power. And then notice, who even forfeits the right to reverse human decisions. Whatever the human being named the animal, that was its name. I mean, can you imagine this? I mean, you got the human being standing here, and God making these animals and sort of bringing them up one by one, and putting them before the human being, and saying, "Well, what are you going to call this one?" Huh? Sort of God in the service of the human creative powers and capacities, huh? And whatever the human being says, that was its name. Now, if you go on, verse 21, verse 20, and the man gave names to all cattle and to the birds of the air and to every animal of the field, but for the man there was not found a helper as his partner. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs, or took a big chunk of his side, is probably a better translation, and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman, and brought her to the man. And the man said, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called woman, for out of man this one was taken." Now notice, this little segment of text starts by God saying, probably to the divine council, the divine community, it's not good, but the story nowhere comes out at the end and says, it's now good. But who makes the statement of goodness, that things are good now? It's the human being that says, at last, this is the way it should be. And so the human being now makes the evaluation that God made all over chapter 1. The human being now makes the evaluation that the creation is good. Now, if you can use your imagination for a moment, but don't let it get too far. Don't get too far. But what if the man, what if the human being here had chosen, I guess the animals are just fine. The animals are just fine. Thanks, God, I will not be alone anymore. The human being, by saying that the animals were insufficient for partner, makes a key decision with respect to the future of the world. By saying no to the animals, so that God now has to go back to the drawing board, and let's see which one that will be just fine for this man, to which the man will say yes. The decision that is made here shapes the future of the world. God gives to human beings the capacity to make decisions that can affect the future of the world. That can shape the future in significant ways. Now, I don't particularly like that. I just assume that God did it all. And it's a little scary, actually, to have that kind of responsibility laid on my shoulders, that I should be given the responsibility to make decisions that will actually make a difference in terms of the shape of the future. But I think that's what we're being told here. That the human being, by saying no to the animals,
sends God back to the drawing boards, and a woman is brought into being, and you have a human race that reaches on into the future.
Now, let me say just a couple more things, and then open it up for conversation. Sin comes into the picture in the balance of the chapters of Genesis. And it's interesting that even in the face of human sin, God does not renege on the initial entrusting of the creature with decision-making activity and involvement in the continuing process of the created order, the becoming of creation, bringing the world along to its fullest possible potential. And I think this is a kind of God is parent that a move that you see here. So there's sin, but God doesn't sort of cut off all freedom, doesn't cut off all entrusting of the human with responsibility. God says, okay, and then notice in what happens in chapter 3, verse 22, verse 23, sorry. After the sin has occurred, therefore the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. There the same task is given to the human, that's the word avath, to serve again. Same task is given to the human being with respect to the rest of the creation, even though sin has intervened in the process in the meantime. And then you move on into the chapters in Genesis, and you do find one righteous man in these chapters, you find Enoch and so forth, but one who is lifted up and given given special attention. Not all human activity subsequent to chapter 3, not all human activity is a betrayal of trust, betrayal of the trust that God has placed in human beings. Noah is a human being who the text says again and again, Noah obeyed the word of the Lord, and Noah was a righteous man. And in exemplary obedience to the word from God, Noah makes sure that the animals get on the ark and are thereby preserved. One of the common observations, you can track this back all the way to Augustine at least, is that in the day seven, seventh day of creation, the phrase evening and morning is missing. You get evening, morning, one day, 2 days, 3 days, but you don't get evening and morning, seventh day. And this is suggested to a lot of folks, that there's a kind of open-endedness to the seventh day. Or more precisely, that God entrusts the newly created human beings with the continuing process of creation, continuing bringing of the creation along toward its fullest potential. I think, again, God is one here who is seen as giving power to the newly created beings, and then takes the parental risk of stepping back and allowing the children to take their first steps in the use of power. And power has not been used very well, and a reclamation of the creation is needed, but God is still entrusting us with these sorts of responsibilities. So, we come back. A relational model of creation, that God chooses not to be involved in creation just all by God's self. God chooses to involve the creatures, both non-human creatures as we've seen, and the human, in the continuing process of creation. And in some sense, don't we need to talk about the dependence of God? That God has freely chosen to be dependent
or at least interdependent, upon that which is not God for the continuing development of the world. Now, the placement of chapter 1, I think, and getting that chapter first, more than chapter 2, suggests that we need to place emphasis upon the divine initiative, upon God's transcendence, upon God's creativity, and as we think through these matters of creation. But the realm of God, the involvement of God, the creative activity of God, and the sphere of the human and the non-human are not radically separated from one another in terms of there are overlapping roles given, overlapping roles, overlapping responsibilities given to both creator and creature. God is not powerful and the creature powerless. In the very act of creating, God gives to that which is other than God a certain independence, a certain freedom, and creative capacities which God will rely upon for the continuing development of the world. Now, one of the things we'll have to talk about on Friday is power and God's giving over power, God's sharing power, and some of what that means in the post-creation world, or at least post-Genesis 1 and 2 world. And so we'll pick up that theme at another time. But let's talk about this, raise some issues, and maybe there's some continuing. Yes, back there, please.
John, what I want to do is just what you did, pick up 322.
Yes, okay. 322, and the Lord God said, see, the man has become like one of us, and there's the one of us language again, the divine community language, knowing good and evil, and now he might reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. You got a particular question about that?
Yeah, it seems like God has succeeded, he's delegated power, doesn't like the result, he's going to kick Adam out of the garden. In other words, he doesn't like the idea that man may have overstepped
right. But in the very next verse, God does not take away from the human the basic responsibilities to which the human had been entrusted in the pre-sin chapters. But there is a removal from the from access to the tree of life. Now there's some discussion on this one. We could really get into this, but let me just suggest a little direction of reflection for you. I think it's likely that human beings were not created immortal, but were created mortal. But that God gave access to a tree of life, which enabled continuing life. So when God makes this move, and 322, to remove them from the tree of life. This does not mean that human beings move from being immortal to being mortal. It means that they don't have access anymore to a special means by which they can continue to live. And so and I think that a key factor probably involved in this is given this what has happened to the human race and its the ill effects on it, the environment that have occurred, it would not be good perhaps for either these human beings or for the creation for them to live forever. There's some kind of move like that. Some people think that God is being threatened here somehow, but I think that's stretching a little bit. You want to come back in any way?
Oh, okay. Well, no, just raising the question whether that would be a valid way to look at that.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yes, please.
In the traditional image of God with which I have been presented, I was somehow told that God knows, and God knows everything, and God has a will, and that somehow, a will for my life and for creation, that somehow I have to find out what is that will of God for me to be happy. With the image you present, that means that God doesn't really know, because he doesn't know what I'm going to do tomorrow. And also that he doesn't have a concrete will on the creature's life.
There's two such small questions. I mean, I think you have perceived correctly that there are significant implications for this kind of reflection on the text for issues of divine foreknowledge and divine will. I think that, let's take the will question, this is very brief, okay, in terms of response, but we can talk more later if you'd like. Let's take the will question first. I think that God has a purpose for the creation, and that purpose is constant, and that the choice of Abraham and people of God is in tune with that fundamental purpose to finally reclaim the creation to be what God intended it to be. But because sin has entered into the world, and that, you might say, that goes against the will of God. Sin is an action that goes against the will of God. It resists the will of God. It's not in tune with the will of God. So God's will is not getting done when people sin. In other words, the will of God can be resisted. We do it every day. God's will for us is not that we sin. Now God then, because there is sin that has entered into the world, God's purposes for the world, the larger purposes for the world, are not thrown into a cocked hat. God is not stymied. God is not immobilized because of this. But God takes what happens in the world and uses it and draws it and aims it and brings it, works good out of evil toward those ultimate purposes which God has in mind. There's a little book on the will of God. May I recommend it highly? It's still in print. It's a million copies have been sold of this book by Leslie Weatherhead. Leslie, just like it sounds, Weatherhead, entitled The Will of God. I think it's the best thing ever written on the will of God. It's only about 60 pages, brief pages. It's actually five little sermons preached by him during the Second World War, when the Nazis were bombing London. And it's just a superb analysis of the world. He makes a distinction between the absolute will of God, the circumstantial will of God, and the ultimate will of God, and tries to sort out some of that. So that's just a quick response to that question. Well, the question of knowledge. God knows all there is to know. But there is a future which has not yet occurred, which is not yet available for knowing. God is omniscient. God knows all there is to know. But there are things that may happen, spontaneous actions on your part and mine, which God knows only as possibilities and not as actualities. And so there's a difference between God's knowledge of the past and God's knowledge of the present. It's over against God's knowledge of the future. God knows what God will do in the future. God will create a new heaven and a new earth, and God will raise the dead from their graves. But that knowledge of the future, I think, and I can give you many texts if you'd like, is not absolute. And so when in Genesis 22, when Abraham is tested by God and Abraham follows through on the instructions to take his boy and sacrifice him, and then when Abraham comes right up to the point of putting the knife in Isaac. You recall verse 12, God says, don't lay your hand on the boy or on anything or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God. What does it mean for God to say, now I know? Well, there are a lot of texts like that, actually, that have been ignored. And we would, God moves into the other option is if God does have absolute knowledge of the future, then God doesn't know some other things. God could never know novelty. Right? God could never know serendipity. God could never know what surprises. So either way you go on this, you're going to have God not knowing something.
Jerry, could you just comment in this connection on whether that, but even in that passage you looked at before on brought the animals before him to see what he would name them. I mean, your stress at that point was upon the delegation of power, but you could also take it as further evidence that really God didn't know what the earth creature was going to name the animals until they were named. So that even that was a kind of, not just a delegation of power, but further evidence that God didn't know in advance what the human being would name the animals. I'm not sure what the Hebrew is there. See what they would name them.
Yeah. I think that's actually connected to your comment, and I didn't want to push the knowledge issue because I didn't know what, but it's both delegation of power, and I think it is God not knowing for sure how the human being is going to respond. I think that's so, how do you understand the fact that okay, God. God says, it's not good that the man should be alone. I'm going to make a helper. And he starts making animals. Is this a sort of an experiment? Trial and error? It's intriguing. I mean, it seems to me that the involvement of the human becomes crucial here for the shaping of the future. And God is not absolutely certain about the turns that human being is going to take.
When God said us, what did he mean? Will you explain that again? You said there was a divine...
I think most scholars, it's a remarkable, not unanimous agreement, but really remarkable majority that think that has reference to a divine community in which God is surrounded by what's called in certain texts, Jeremiah 23, for example, the divine council. God is surrounded by angelic creatures with whom God is in conversation. And one of the interesting things you get in the prophets, Jeremiah says, with regard to the false prophets, I mean, who among you has stood in the council of the Lord? It's sort of like Jeremiah's been invited into that heavenly administrative committee room and is allowed to sit in a little chair back in the corner and to overhear what they're saying. I think that's what's going on here. It's a divine community. I think this material is very important for later Trinitarian developments. So that when it comes to talking about the more complex understandings of God, this material indicates that the heavenly community is rich and complex. God's not in heaven alone. Yes, please.
In chapter 1, verse 28, before God said to humankind, fruitful and multiply, he says, God blessed them. To me, that seems significant.
Yes.
Because it creates a relationship between man and God. And that, it also sounds like he loves them.
Right.
Can you...
The word blessing is a big word. Notice who else is blessed in this chapter. Who else is blessed among the creatures? Only God blesses twice in this chapter. And the other one is back in verse 22. When created the animals, not all of them, the initial group of them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. God blessed them saying, be fruitful, multiply, fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply in the earth. You notice that there's a lot of continuity between God's blessing of the animals there and God's commanding the animals. They get to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, command too. I mean, so that human beings are not distinctive in that regard. It's to have dominion, and it's the doing where the distinctiveness comes in. But you're right, the blessing language, blessing is basically potentiation. Yeah? The giving of power to the other to accomplish certain ends, in this case primarily fertility, the continuing of the race in connection to human beings, and continuing of the animal world. God has decided, I am not going to do the procreating. I mean, I'm giving that powers of fertility, the power to carry on the creation, I'm giving that over to the creatures. And so that's sort of captured in the language of blessing. There was one other thought that just flitted through my mind there. I don't know, is that responding to your concern there? Other questions or comments you might have?
Well, I'm wondering about the book of John, the first chapter. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So doesn't that mean that Christ already was he part of the divine council at that time?
Mm-hmm. Interesting way of putting the question. Let me start off by saying maybe a little controversial comment, but and then back away from it a little bit and see if we can. You and I, as Christians, know more about the God who is active in this text and in other Old Testament texts than the authors of the books did. That is to say that when Jesus came his life, death, and resurrection, and then the giving of the Spirit at Pentecost, these events caught up in New Testament materials and passed down through the generations have enabled us to talk about God in ways that are fuller, more complete than was possible for the Old Testament writers. So the Gospel of John, the text which you read, wants to make a claim that the God who was involved in Genesis 1 was a Trinitarian God. But the authors of Genesis 1 have not gotten to that theological point of development yet. You get some hints of it in the Spirit of God moving over the face of the waters in verse 2. But we would want to confess that a God who was Trinitarian, huh, was involved in the creation of the world. But we can't make Genesis 1 say everything that we now know about that God because of Jesus. Huh? Is that clear? If not, I'd be happy to talk about that. Yes. Somebody else. Yes.
This idea that God has a need for us in relationship and that there is an interdependence. The word need is a word that I know I have grown up with our children. We've always emphasized the difference between a need and a want.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, what you need are your clothes and your food and things to keep your body and your mind healthy. And what you want are some of those extra things that maybe fill in the gaps a bit.
Uh-huh.
So I guess the question I'm trying to get at is, if we don't meet some of God's needs, then what part of God is lacking then? Or what part of God may go wanting?
And tomorrow we're going to talk about, is God affected by you? Yes, indeed, I think. That's an interesting distinction that you make. And I think that God's got both wants and needs. And now it's the language of dependence is made problematic these days because of its use in the phrase codependence. And so one might sort of make a move from dependence, is God codependent then? But I think that the language of dependence need not necessarily be taken down that track. I think that God has freely chosen. I want to get the freedom, God's freedom stuff in here. God has freely chosen to take this way with the world, to catch up that which is not God in the continuing bringing of the creation, the becoming of the creation. And this has to do with what we were talking about yesterday. What does it mean to be in a genuine relationship? In a genuine relationship, that means that you, as one party to the relationship, you're not the only one that has something important to do. To be in a genuine relationship is to be, in some sense, dependent upon the other who is with you in this relationship. And God has freely chosen to take that test. Now, one of the questions we will raise on Friday with regard to that point is, does God, in making the kind of moves that God does in the first chapters of Genesis, have dominion, subdue the earth, does God put constraints on God's self? I'm giving this over to the creature to do, and I entrust that task to the creature, and I'm going to back off and let the creature freely act in this regard. And does that mean that we need to talk about constraints and restraints that God has placed on God's self here in order to make sure that the creature is freely involved in the becoming of creation? Now, if you take a word like need, you can also push it and talk about the word needy, which is, it's even more if it's God needy. We can work with language like that. I don't want to push that language too much, but I think we need to talk about divine need. I think we need to talk about divine dependence. And it's interesting. We say this. Jesus came to reveal God to us. And Jesus did reveal God most supremely to us, right? And Jesus has clearly presents those around him with needs. Jesus is taken care of by others. Look at the first few verses of Luke 8, for example, and how the women provide for his needs, take care of him. Jesus is dependent upon others. There's an interesting article on sort of divine dependence written by Robert Bertram, who used to teach at LSDC in Concordia, St. Louis. In a little book edited by Carl Broughton entitled Our Naming of God, Problems and Prospect of God Talk Today. And listen to this very, very striking formulation. The one God on whom everything depends is simultaneously, as we are, one who depends. A child. But the child, capitalized, is not for that reason any less God. The one who is dependent upon is, of course, God, but the one who does the depending is likewise God. And that's nice. I mean, it's very subtle.
But I think that it conveys a real truth. I think, again, we would just assume that God not choose that direction to relate to us and to our world. But here we are, and where are we going to take this? Yes, please.
But is there not still the involvement of God within the choices that we make, so that maybe instead of using the term the will of God, we ought to talk about the yearning of God?
Yeah.
Something on that order.
God, one of the things we tried to suggest yesterday with regard to relationship is that God fills the earth, and God's love fills the earth. God is present at every event and active in every occasion, but not in an all-determining way for the sake of a genuine relationship. Yes, we do want to talk about the continuing presence and activity of God, the Spirit, in our lives, working God's will, working toward God's purposes. But that will of God is resistible. And God will have to find some other maneuvers to make God's way into the future toward those ultimate goals. Is the bell. Tomorrow what I'd like to do, as I suggested, is to raise the question, is God affected by you? And talk a little bit about the feelings of God and the emotions of God, and how they might come to play a part in our continuing talk about God as one who has entered into a genuine relationship with us.